you. And he said I should just give you what you wanted, even if it was just a plate of lettuce or a strawberry milkshake. And I said I was just trying to get you to eat something healthy. And he said you couldn't help it. And I said, well, I couldn't help it either, and I just lost my rag. And he said that if he could keep his temper, then I should bloody well keep my temper. And it went on and on like this. And I couldn't walk properly for a month, do you remember? And your father had to look after you. And I remember looking at the two of you and seeing you together and thinking how you were really different with him, much calmer. And you didn't shout at one another. And it made me so sad, because it was like you really didn't need me at all. And somehow, that was even worse than you and me arguing all the time, because it was like I was invisible. And I think that was when I realized you and your father were probably better off if I wasn't living in the house. Then he'd only have one person to look after instead of two. Then Roger said that he had asked the bank for a transfer. That means he asked them if he could have a job in London, and he was leaving. He asked me if I wanted to come with him. I thought about it for a long time, Christopher. Honestly, I did. And it broke my heart. But eventually I decided it would be better for all of us if I went. So I said yes. I meant to say goodbye. I was going to come back and pick up some clothes when you were back from school. And that was when I was going to explain what I was doing and say that I would come back and see you as often as I could and you could come down to London sometimes to stay with us. But when I rang your father, he said I couldn't come back. He was really angry. He said I couldn't talk to you. I didn't know what to do. He said that I was being selfish and that I was never to set foot inside the house again, so I haven't. But I have written you these letters instead. I wonder if you can understand any of this. I know it'll be very difficult for you, but I hope you can understand a little. Christopher, I never meant to hurt you. I thought that what I was doing was the best for all of us. I hope it is. And I want you to know that this is not your fault. I used to have dreams that everything would get better. Do you remember you used to say that you wanted to be an astronaut? Well, I used to have dreams that you were an astronaut, and you were on the television, and I thought, that's my son. I wonder what it is that you want to be now. Has it changed? Are you still doing maths? I hope you are. Please, Christopher, write to me sometime, or ring me on the telephone. The number's at the top of the letter. Love and kisses. Your mother. Then I opened a third envelope. This was the letter that was inside. 18th September, Flat 1, 312 Lausanne Road, London, N8, 0208-756-4321. Dear Christopher, well, I said I'd write you every week, and I have. In fact, this is the second letter this week, so I'm doing even better than I said. I have a job. I'm working in Camden at Perkin and Rashid, which is a chartered surveyors. That means they go around looking at houses and work out how much they should cost and what work needs to be done on them and how much that work will cost. And also, they work out how much new houses and offices and factories will cost to build. It's a nice office. The other secretary is Angie. Her desk is covered in little teddy bears and furry toys and pictures of her children, so I've put a picture of you in a frame on my desk. She's really nice, and we always go out for lunch together. I don't know how long I'll stay here, though. I have to do a lot of adding up of numbers for when we send bills out to clients, and I'm not very good at doing this. You'd be better at it than I am. The company is run by two men called Mr. Perkin and Mr. Rashid. Mr. Rashid is from Pakistan and very stern and always wants us to work faster. And Mr. Perkin is weird. Angie calls him Pervy Perkin. When he comes and stands next to me to ask a question, he always puts his hand on my shoulder and squats down so his face is really near mine and I can smell his toothpaste, which gives me the creeps. And the pay is not very good either, so I shall be looking for something better as soon as I get the chance. I went up to Alexandra Palace the other day. It's a big park just round the corner from our flat, and the park is a huge hill with a big conference centre on the top, and it made me think of you, because if you came here, we could go there and fly kites or watch the planes coming into Heathrow Airport, and I know you'd like that. I have to go now, Christopher. I'm writing this in my lunch hour. Angie's off sick with the flu, so we can't have lunch together. Please write to me sometime and tell me about how you are and what you're doing at school. I hope you got the present I sent you. Have you solved it yet? Roger and I saw it in a shop in Camden Market, and I know you've always liked puzzles. Roger tried to get the two pieces apart before we wrapped it up, but he couldn't do it. He said that if you managed to do it, you were a genius. Loads and loads of love. Your mother. And this was the fourth letter. 23rd August, Flat 1, 312 Lausanne Road, London, N8. Dear Christopher, I'm sorry I didn't write last week. I had to go to the dentist and have two of my molars out. You might not remember when we had to take you to the dentist. You wouldn't let anyone put their hand inside your mouth, so we had to put you to sleep so that the dentist could take one of your teeth out. Well, they didn't put me to sleep. They just gave me what is called a local anaesthetic, which means that you can't feel anything in your mouth, which is just as well because they had to saw through the bone to get the tooth out. And it didn't hurt at all. In fact, I was laughing because the dentist had to tug and pull and strain so much, and it seemed really funny to me. But when I got home, the pain started to come back, and I had to lie on the sofa for 2 days and take lots of painkillers. Then I stopped reading the letter, because I felt sick. Mother had not had a heart attack. Mother had not died. Mother had been alive all the time. And Father had lied about this. I tried really hard to think if there was any other explanation, but I couldn't think of one. And then I couldn't think of anything at all, because my brain wasn't working properly. I felt giddy. It was like the room was swinging from side to side, as if it was at the top of a really tall building and the building was swinging backwards and forwards in a strong wind. This is a simile too. But I knew that the room couldn't be swinging backwards and forwards, so it must have been something which was happening inside my head. I rolled onto the bed and curled up in a ball. My stomach hurt. I don't know what happened then, because there's a gap in my memory, like a bit of the tape had been erased. But I know that a lot of time must have passed, because later on, when I opened my eyes again, I could see that it was dark outside the window. And I'd been sick, because there was sick all over the bed and on my hands and arms and face. But before this, I heard Father coming into the house and calling out my name, which is another reason why I know a lot of time had passed. And it was strange, because he was calling, "Christopher? Christopher?" And I could see my name written out as he was saying it. Often I can see what someone is saying written out, like it's being printed on a computer screen, especially if they're in another room. But this wasn't on a computer screen. I could see it written really large, like it was on a big advert on the side of a bus. And it was in my mother's handwriting, with little circles over the letter I. And then I heard Father come up the stairs and walk into the room. He said, "Christopher, what the hell are you doing?" And I could tell that he was in the room, but his voice sounded tiny and far away, like people's voices sometimes do when I'm groaning and I don't want them to be near me. And he said, "What the fuck are you..." "That's my cupboard, Christopher. Those are..." Oh, shit. Shit, 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 shit. Then he said nothing for a while. Then he put his hand on my shoulder and moved me onto my side and he said, "Oh, Christ." But it didn't hurt when he touched me, like it normally does. I could see him touching me, like I was watching a film of what was happening in the room, but I could hardly feel his hand at all. It was just like the wind blowing against me. And then he was silent again for a while. Then he said, "I'm sorry, Christopher. I'm so, so sorry." And then I noticed again that I had been sick, because I could feel something wet all over me, and I could smell it, like when someone's sick at school. Then he said, "You read the letters." Then I could hear that he was crying, because his breath sounded all bubbly and wet, like it does when someone has a cold and they have lots of snot in their nose. Then he said, "I did it for your good, Christopher. Honestly, I did. I never meant to lie. I just thought it was better if you didn't know that I didn't mean to. I was going to show them to you when you were older." Then he was silent again. Then he said, "It was an accident." Then he was silent again. Then he said, "I didn't know what to say. I was in such a mess. She left a note, and then she rang, and I said she was in hospital because I didn't know how to explain. It was so complicated, so difficult. And I said she was in hospital. And I know it wasn't true, but once I'd said that, I couldn't change it. Do you understand, Christopher? Christopher? It got out of control, and I wish..." Then he was silent for a really long time. Then he touched me on the shoulder again and said, "Christopher, we have to get you cleaned up, okay?" He shook my shoulder a little bit, but I didn't move. And he said, "Christopher, I'm going to go to the bathroom and I'm going to run you a hot bath. Then I'm going to come back and take you to the bathroom, okay? Then I can put the sheets into the washing machine." Then I heard him get up and go to the bathroom and turn the taps on. I listened to the water running into the bath. He didn't come back for a while. Then he came back and touched my shoulder again and said, "Let's do this really gently, Christopher. Let's sit you up and get your clothes off and get you into the bath, okay? I'm going to have to touch you, but it's going to be all right." Then he lifted me up and made me sit on the side of the bed. He took my jumper and my shirt off and put them on the bed. Then he made me stand up and walk through to the bathroom. And I didn't scream. And I didn't fight. And I didn't hit him. Chapter 163. When I was little and I first went to school, my main teacher was called Julie, because Siobhan hadn't started working at the school then. She only started working at the school when I was 12. And one day, Julie sat down at a desk next to me and put a tube of Smarties on the desk, and she said, "Christopher, what do you think is in here?" And I said, "Smarties." Then she took the top off the Smarties tube and turned it upside down, and a little red pencil came out. And she laughed, and I said, "It's not Smarties, it's a pencil." Then she put the little red pencil back inside the Smarties tube and put the top back on. Then she said, "If your mummy came in now and we asked her what was inside the Smarties tube, what do you think she would say?" Because I used to call Mother Mummy then, not Mother. And I said, "A pencil." That was because when I was little, I didn't understand about other people having minds. And Julie said to Mother and Father that I would always find this very difficult. But I don't find this difficult now, because I decided that it was a kind of puzzle, and if something is a puzzle, there's always a way of solving it. It's like computers. People think computers are different from people because they don't have minds, even though in the Turing test, computers can have conversations with people about the weather and wine and what Italy is like, and they can even tell jokes. But the mind is just a complicated machine. And when we look at things, We think we're just looking out of our eyes, like we're looking out of little windows and there's a person inside our head. But we're not. We're looking at a screen inside our heads, like a computer screen. And you can tell this because of an experiment which I saw on a TV series called How the Mind Works. And in this experiment, you put your head in a clamp and you look at a page of writing on a screen. And it looks like a normal page of writing and nothing is changing. But after a while, as your eye moves round the page, you realise that something is very strange. Because when you try to read a bit of the page you've read before, it's different. And this is because when your eye flicks from one point to another, you don't see anything at all and you're blind. And the flicks are called saccades. Because if you saw everything when your eye flicked from one point to another, you'd feel giddy. And in the experiment, there's a sensor which tells when your eye is flicking from one place to another, and when it's doing this, it changes some of the words on the page in a place where you're not looking. But you don't notice that you're blind during saccades because your brain fills in the screen in your head to make it seem like you're looking out of two little windows in your head. And you don't notice that words have changed on another part of the page because your mind fills in a picture of things you're not looking at that moment. And people are different from animals because they can have pictures on the screens in their heads of things which they are not looking at. They can have pictures of someone in another room, or they can have a picture of what's going to happen tomorrow, or they can have pictures of themselves as an astronaut, or they can have pictures of really big numbers, or they can have pictures of chains of reasoning when they're trying to work something out. And that is why a dog can go to the vet and have a really big operation and have metal pins sticking out of its leg, but if it sees a cat, it forgets that it has pins sticking out of its leg and chases after the cat. But when a person has an operation, it has a picture in its head of the hurt carrying on for months and months. And it has a picture of all the stitches in its leg and the broken bone and the pins. And even if it sees a bus it has to catch, it doesn't run because it has a picture in its head of the bones crunching together and the stitches breaking and even more pain. And that's why people think that computers don't have minds, and why people think that their brains are special and different from computers. Because people can see the screen inside their head, and they think there's someone in their head sitting there looking at the screen, like Captain Jean-Luc Picard in Star Trek: The Next Generation, sitting in his captain's seat looking at a big screen. And they think that this person is their special human mind, which is called a homunculus, which means little man. And they think that computers don't have this homunculus. But this homunculus is just another picture on the screen in their heads. And when the homunculus is on the screen in their heads, because the person is thinking about the homunculus, there's another bit of the brain watching the screen. And when the person thinks about this part of the brain, the bit that's watching the homunculus on the screen, they put this bit of the brain on the screen. And there's another bit of the brain watching the screen. But the brain doesn't see this happen because it's like the eye flicking from one place to another, and people are blind inside their heads when they do the changing from thinking about one thing to thinking about another. And this is why people's brains are like computers. And it's not because they're special, but because they have to keep turning off for fractions of a second while the screen changes. And because there's something they can't see, people think it has to be special. Because people always think there's something special about what they can't see, like the dark side of the moon, or the other side of a black hole, or in the dark when they wake up at night and they're scared. Also, people think they're not computers because they have feelings and computers don't have feelings. But feelings are just having a picture on the screen in your head of what is going to happen tomorrow or next year, or what might have happened instead of what did happen. And if it's a happy picture, they smile. And if it's a sad picture, they cry. Chapter 167. After Father had given me a bath and cleaned the sick off me and dried me off with a towel, he took me to my bedroom and put some clean clothes on me. Then he said, "Have you had anything to eat yet this evening?" but I didn't say anything. Then he said, "Can I get you anything to eat, Christopher?" But I still didn't say anything. So he said, "Okay, look, I'm going to go and put your clothes and the bed sheets into the washing machine, and then I'll come back, okay?" I sat on the bed and looked at my knees. So Father went out of the room and picked up my clothes from the bathroom floor and put them on the landing. Then he went and got the sheets from his bed and brought them out onto the landing together with my shirt and my jumper. Then he picked them all up and took them downstairs. Then I heard him start the washing machine, and I heard the boiler starting up and the water in the pipes going into the washing machine. That was all I could hear for a long time. I doubled twos in my head because it made me feel calmer. I got to 33,554,432, which is 2 to the 25th power, which was not very much because I've gotten to 2 to the 45th power before, but my brain wasn't working very well. Then Father came back into the room again and said, "How are you feeling? Can I get you anything?" I didn't say anything. I carried on looking at my knees. And Father didn't say anything either. He just sat down on the bed next to me and put his elbows on his knees and looked down at the carpet between his legs, where there was a little red piece of Lego with 8 knobbles on. Then I heard Toby waking up because he's nocturnal, and I heard him rustling in his cage. And Father was silent for a really long time. Then he said, "Look, maybe I shouldn't say this, but I want you to know that you can trust me. And, okay, maybe I don't tell the truth all the time. God knows I try, Christopher. God knows I do, but life is difficult, you know? It's bloody hard telling the truth all the time. Sometimes it's impossible. And I want you to know that I'm trying. I really am. And perhaps this is not a very good time to say this, and I know you're not going to like it, but you have to know that I'm going to tell you the truth from now on about everything. Because if you don't tell the truth now, then later on it hurts even more. So..." Father rubbed his face with his hands and pulled his chin down with his fingers and stared at the wall. I could see him out of the corner of my eye. And he said, "I killed Wellington, Christopher." I wondered if this was a joke, because I don't understand jokes, and when people tell jokes, they don't mean what they say. But then Father said, "Please, Christopher, just let me explain." Then he sucked in some air and he said, "When your mum left, Eileen, Mrs. Shears, she was very good to us, very good to me. She helped me through a very difficult time, and I'm not sure I would have made it without her. Well, you know how she was round here most days, helping out with the cooking and the cleaning, popping over to see if we were okay, if we needed anything. I thought, well... shit, Christopher, I'm trying to keep this simple. I thought she might carry on coming over. I thought, maybe I was being stupid, I thought she might eventually want to move in here. Or that we might move into her house. We got on really, really well. I thought we were friends. And I guess I thought wrong. I guess, in the end, it comes down to... shit. We argued, Christopher, and she said some things I'm not going to say to you, because they're not nice, but they hurt. But I think she cared more for that bloody dog than for me. For us. And maybe that's not so stupid, looking back. Maybe we are a bloody handful. And maybe it is easier living on your own looking after some stupid mutt than sharing your life with other actual human beings. I mean... shit, buddy, we're not exactly low maintenance, are we? Anyway, we had this row. Well, quite a few rows, to be honest. But after this particularly nasty little blowout, she chucked me out the house. And you know what that bloody dog was like after the operation? Bloody schizophrenic, nice as pie one moment, roll over, tickle its stomach, sink its teeth into your leg the next. Anyway, we're yelling at each other, and it's in the garden relieving itself. So when she slams the door behind me, the bugger's waiting for me. And I know, maybe if I'd just given it a kick, it would probably have backed off, but shit, Christopher, when that red mist comes down... Christ, you know how it is. I mean, we're not that different, you and me. And all I could think about was that she cared more about this bloody dog than she did about you or me. And it was like everything I'd been bottling up for 2 years just... And then Father was silent for a bit. Then he said, "I'm sorry, Christopher. I promise you I never meant for it to turn out like this." And then I knew that it wasn't a joke, and I was really frightened. Father said, "We all make mistakes, Christopher. You, me, your mum, everyone. And sometimes they're really big mistakes. We're only human." Then he held up his right hand and spread his fingers out in a fan. But I screamed and pushed him backwards so that he fell off the bed and onto the floor. He sat up and said, "Okay, look, Christopher, I'm sorry. Let's leave it for tonight, okay? I'm going to go downstairs, and you get some sleep, and we'll talk in the morning." Then he said, "It's going to be all right, honestly. Trust me." Then he stood up and took a deep breath and went out of the room. I sat on the bed for a long time looking at the floor. Then I heard Toby scratching in his cage. I looked up and saw him staring through the bars at me. I had to get out of the house. Father had murdered Wellington. That meant he could murder me, because I couldn't trust him, even though he had said trust me, because he had told a lie about a big thing. But I couldn't get out of the house straight away, because he'd see me, so I'd have to wait until he was asleep. The time was 11:16 p.m. I tried doubling twos again, but I couldn't get past 2 to the 15th power, which was 32,768, so I groaned to make the time pass quicker and not think. Then it was 1:20 a.m., but I hadn't heard Father come upstairs to bed. I wondered if he was asleep downstairs or whether he was waiting to come in and kill me. So I got out my Swiss Army knife and opened the saw blade so that I could defend myself. Then I went out of my bedroom really quietly and listened. I couldn't hear anything, so I started going downstairs really quietly and really slowly. And when I got downstairs, I could see Father's foot through the door of the living room. I waited for 4 minutes to see if it moved, but it didn't move. So I carried on walking till I got to the hallway. Then I looked round the door of the living room. Father was lying on the sofa with his eyes closed. I looked at him for a long time. Then he snored, and I jumped, and I could hear the blood in my ears, and my heart going really fast, and a pain like someone had blown up a really big balloon inside my chest. I wondered if I was going to have a heart attack. Father's eyes were still closed. I wondered if he was pretending to be asleep, so I gripped the penknife really hard, and I knocked on the doorframe. Father moved his head from one side to the other, and his foot twitched, and he said, but his eyes stayed closed, and then he snored again. He was asleep. That meant I could get out of the house if I was really quiet so I didn't wake him up. I took both my coats and my scarf from the hooks next to the front door, and I put them all on because it would be cold outside at night. Then I went upstairs again really quietly, but it was difficult because my legs were shaking. I went into my room and I picked up Toby's cage. He was making scratching noises, so I took off one of the coats and put it over the cage to make the noise quieter. Then I carried him downstairs again. Father was still asleep. I went into the kitchen and I picked up my special food box. I unlocked the back door and stepped outside. Then I held the handle of the door down as I shut it again so that the click wasn't too loud. Then I walked down to the bottom of the garden. At the bottom of the garden is a shed, It has the lawnmower and the hedge cutter in, and lots of gardening equipment that Mother used to use, like pots and bags of compost and bamboo canes and string and spades. It would be a bit warmer in the shed, but I knew that Father might look for me in the shed, so I went round the back of the shed and I squeezed into the gap between the wall of the shed and the fence, behind the big black plastic tub for collecting rainwater. Then I sat down, and I felt a bit safer. I decided to leave my other coat over Toby's cage because I didn't want him to get cold and die. I opened up my special food box. Inside was the Milky Bar and two licorice laces and three clementines and a pink wafer biscuit and my red food colouring. I didn't feel hungry, but I knew that I should eat something because if you don't eat something, you can get cold. So I ate two clementines and the Milky Bar. Then I wondered what I would do next. Chapter 173. Between the roof of the shed and the big plant that hangs over the fence from the house next door, I could see the constellation Orion. People say that Orion is called Orion because Orion was a hunter, and the constellation looks like a hunter with a club and a bow and arrow. But this is really silly because it's just stars, and you could join up the dots in any way you wanted, and you could make it look like a lady with an umbrella who's waving, or the coffee maker which Mrs. Shears has, which is from Italy, with a handle and steam coming out, or like a dinosaur. And there aren't any lines in space, so you could join bits of Orion to bits of Lepus or Taurus or Gemini and say that they were a constellation called the Bunch of Grapes or Jesus or the Bicycle, except that they didn't have bicycles in Roman and Greek times, which was when they called Orion Orion. And anyway, Orion is not a hunter or a coffee maker or a dinosaur. It's just Betelgeuse and Bellatrix and Anilam and Rigel. And 17 other stars I don't know the names of. And they are nuclear explosions billions of miles away. And that is the truth. Chapter 179. I stayed awake until 3:47, and that was the last time I looked at my watch before I fell asleep. It has a luminous face and lights up if you press a button, so I could read it in the dark. I was cold, and I was frightened Father might come out and find me, but I felt safer in the garden because I was hidden. I looked at the sky a lot. I like looking up at the sky in the garden at night. In summer, I sometimes come outside at night with my torch and my planisphere, which is two circles of plastic with a pin through the middle. And on the bottom is a map of the sky, and on top is an aperture, which is an opening shaped in a parabola, and you turn it round to see a map of the sky that you can see on that day of the year from the latitude 51.5 degrees north, which is the latitude that Swindon is on, because the largest bit of the sky is always on the other side of the earth. And when you look at the sky, you know you're looking at stars which are hundreds and thousands of light years away from you. And some of the stars don't even exist anymore, because their light has taken so long to get to us that they're already dead, or they've exploded and collapsed into red dwarfs. And that makes you seem very small. And if you have difficult things in your life, it's nice to think that they're what is called negligible, which means that they're so small you don't have to take them into account when you're calculating something. I didn't sleep very well because of the cold and because the ground was very bumpy and pointy underneath me and because Toby was scratching in his cage a lot. But when I woke up properly, it was dawn and the sky was all orange and blue and purple and I could hear birds singing, which is called the dawn chorus. And I stayed where I was for another 2 hours and 32 minutes and then I heard Father come into the garden and call out, "Christopher! Christopher!" So I turned round, and I found an old plastic sack covered in mud that used to have fertilizer in it, and I squeezed myself and Toby's cage and my special food box into the corner between the wall of the shed and the fence and the rainwater tub, and I covered myself with the fertilizer sack. And then I heard Father coming down the garden, and I took my Swiss Army knife out of my pocket and got out the saw blade and held it in case he found us. And I heard him open the door of the shed and look inside. Then I heard him say, "Shit." And then I heard his footsteps in the bushes round the side of the shed, and my heart was beating really fast, and I could feel the feeling like a balloon inside my chest again. And I think he might have looked round the back of the shed, but I couldn't see because I was hiding. But he didn't see me, because I heard him walking back up the garden again. Then I stayed still, and I looked at my watch, and I stayed still for 27 minutes. And then I heard Father start the engine of his van. I knew it was his van, because I heard it very often, and it was nearby. And I knew it wasn't any of the neighbours' cars, because the people who take drugs have a Volkswagen camper van, and Mr. Thompson, who lives at number 40, has a Vauxhall Cavalier, and the people who live at number 34 have a Peugeot, and they all sound different. And when I heard him drive away from the house, I knew it would be safe to come out. And then I had to decide what to do, because I couldn't live in the house with Father anymore, because it was dangerous. So I made a decision. I decided that I would go and knock on Mrs. Shear's door, and I would go and live with her, because I knew her and she wasn't a stranger, and I had stayed in her house before when there was a power cut on our side of the street. And this time she wouldn't tell me to go away, because I'd be able to tell her who had killed Wellington, and that way she would know that I was a friend. And also she would understand why I couldn't live with Father anymore. I took the licorice laces and the pink wafer biscuit and the last clementine out of my special food box and put them in my pocket and hid the special food box under the fertilizer bag. Then I picked up Toby's cage and my extra coat and I climbed out from behind the shed. I walked up the garden and down the side of the house. I undid the bolt in the garden door and walked out in front of the house. There was no one in the street, so I crossed and walked up the drive to Mrs. Shear's house and knocked on the door and waited and worked out what I was going to say when she opened the door. But she didn't come to the door, so I knocked again. Then I turned round and saw some people walking down the street, and I was frightened again because it was two of the people who take drugs in the house next door. So I grabbed Toby's cage and went round the side of Mrs. Shear's house and sat down behind the dustbin so they couldn't see me. And then I had to work out what to do. And I did this by thinking of all the things I could do and deciding whether they were the right decision or not. I decided that I couldn't go home again. And I decided that I couldn't go and live with Siobhan, because she couldn't look after me when school was closed, because she was a teacher and not a friend or a member of my family. And I decided that I couldn't go and live with Uncle Terry, because he lived in Sunderland, and I didn't know how to get to Sunderland, and I didn't like Uncle Terry, because he smoked cigarettes and stroked my hair. And I decided I couldn't go and live with Mrs. Alexander, because she wasn't a friend or a member of my family, even if she had a dog, because I couldn't stay overnight in the house or use her toilet because she had used it and she was a stranger. And then I thought that I could go and live with Mother, because she was my family, and I knew where she lived because I could remember the address from the letters, which was 451C Chapter Road, London NW25NG, except that she lived in London, and I'd never been to London before. I'd only been to Dover to go to France, and to Sunderland to visit Uncle Terry, and to Manchester to visit Aunt Ruth, who had cancer, except she didn't have cancer when I was there. And I had never been anywhere, apart from the shop at the end of the road, on my own. And the thought of going somewhere on my own was frightening. But then I thought about going home again, or staying where I was, or hiding in the garden every night, and Father finding me, and that made me feel even more frightened. And when I thought about that, I felt like I was going to be sick again, like I did the night before. And then I realized that there was nothing I could do which felt safe. And I made a picture in my head of all the possibilities. 1. Living with Mrs. Shears. 2. Going home. 3. Staying in the garden. 4. Going to live with Uncle Terry. 5. Going to live with Mother. And then I imagined crossing out all the possibilities which were impossible, which is like in a maths exam, when you look at all the questions and you decide which ones you're going to do and which ones you're not going to do, and you cross out all the ones which you're not going to do because then your decision is final and you can't change your mind. Which meant that I had to go to London to live with Mother. And I could do it by going on a train, because I knew all about trains from the train set, how you looked at the timetable and went to the station and bought a ticket and looked at the departure board to see if your train was on time, and then you went to the right platform and got on board. And I would go from Swindon Station, where Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson stop for lunch when they're on their way to Ross from Paddington in the Boscombe Valley mystery.
This ends Disc 3. The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, Disc 4.
And then I looked at the wall on the opposite side of the little passage down the side of Mrs. Shear's house where I was sitting, and there was the circular lid of a very old metal pan leaning against the wall, and it was covered in rust. And it looked like the surface of a planet, because the rust was shaped like countries and continents and islands. And then I thought how I could never be an astronaut, because being an astronaut meant being hundreds of thousands of miles away from home. And my home was in London now, and that was about 100 miles away, which was more than 1,000 times nearer than my home would be if I was in space. And thinking about this made me hurt. Like when I fell over in the grass at the edge of a playground once, and I cut my knee on a piece of broken bottle that someone had thrown over the wall, and I sliced a flap of skin off, and Mr. Davis had to clean the flesh under the flap with disinfectant to get the germs and the dirt out, and it hurt so much I cried. But this hurt was inside my head, and it made me sad to think that I could never become an astronaut. And then I thought that I had to be like Sherlock Holmes, and I had to detach my mind at will to a remarkable degree, so that I didn't notice how much it was hurting inside my head. And then I thought I would need money if I was going to go to London, and I would need food to eat, because it was a long journey and I wouldn't know where to get food from. And then I thought I would need someone to look after Toby when I went to London, because I couldn't take him with me. And then I formulated a plan, and that made me feel better, because there was something inside my head that had an order and a pattern, and I just had to follow the instructions, one after the other. I stood up, and I made sure there was no one in the street. Then I went to Mrs. Alexander's house, which is next door to Mrs. Shear's house, and I knocked on the door. Then Mrs. Alexander opened the door, and she said, "Christopher, what on earth has happened to you?" And I said, "Can you look after Toby for me?" And she said, "Who's Toby?" And I said, "Toby's my pet rat." Then Mrs. Alexander said, Oh, yes, I remember now. You told me." Then I held Toby's cage up and said, "This is him." Mrs. Alexander took a step backwards into her hallway. And I said, "He eats special pellets, and you can buy them from a pet shop. But he also eats biscuits and carrots and bread and chicken bones. But you mustn't give him chocolate, because it's got caffeine and theobromine in, which are methyl xanthines, and it's poisonous for rats in large quantities. And he needs new water in his bottle every day, too. And he won't mind being in someone else's house, because he's an animal. And he likes to come out of his cage, but it doesn't matter if you don't take him out." Then Mrs. Alexander said, "Why do you need someone to look after Toby, Christopher?" And I said, "I'm going to London." And she said, "How long are you going for?" And I said, "Until I go to university." And she said, "Can't you take Toby with you?" And I said, "London's a long way away, and I don't want to take him on the train, because I might lose him." And Mrs. Alexander said, "Right." And then she said, "Are you and your father moving house?" And I said, "No." And she said, "So why are you going to London?" And I said, "I'm going to live with Mother." And she said, "I thought you told me your mother was dead." And I said, "I thought she was dead, but she was still alive, and Father lied to me. And also, he said he killed Wellington. And Mrs. Alexander said, "Oh, my goodness." And I said, "I'm going to live with my mother, because Father killed Wellington, and he lied, and I'm frightened of being in the house with him." And Mrs. Alexander said, "Is your mother here?" And I said, "No, Mother is in London." And she said, "So you're going to London on your own?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Look, Christopher, why don't you come inside and sit down and we can talk about this and work out what's the best thing to do?" And I said, "No, I can't come inside. Will you look after Toby for me?" And she said, "I really don't think that would be a good idea, Christopher." And I didn't say anything. And she said, "Where's your father at the moment, Christopher?" And I said, "I don't know." And she said, "Well, perhaps we should try and give him a ring and see if we can get in touch with him. I'm sure he's worried about you, and I'm sure that there's been some dreadful misunderstanding." So I turned round, and I ran across the road back to our house. And I didn't look before I crossed the road, and a yellow Mini had to stop, and the tyres squealed on the road. And I ran down the side of the house and back through the garden gate, and I bolted it behind me. I tried to open the kitchen door, but it was locked, so I picked up a brick that was lying on the ground, and I smashed it through the window, and the glass shattered everywhere. Then I put my arm through the broken glass, and I opened the door from the inside. I went into the house, and I put Toby down on the kitchen table. Then I ran upstairs, and I grabbed my school bag, and I put some food for Toby in it, and some of my maths books, and some clean pants and a vest and a clean shirt. Then I came downstairs, and I opened the fridge, and I put a carton of orange juice into my bag, and a bottle of milk that hadn't been opened. And I took two more clementines, and two tins of baked beans and a packet of custard creams from the cupboard, and I put them in my bag as well, because I could open them with the can opener on my Swiss Army knife. Then I looked at the surface next to the sink, and I saw Father's mobile phone, and his wallet, and his address book, and I felt my skin cold under my clothes, like Dr. Watson in The Sign of the Four, when he sees the tiny footsteps of Tonga, the Andaman Islander, on the roof of Bartholomew Sholto's house in Norwood, because I thought Father had come back and he was in the house, and the pain in my head got much worse. But then I rewound the pictures in my memory, and I saw that his van wasn't parked outside the house, so he must have left his mobile phone and his wallet and his address book when he left the house. And I picked up his wallet and I took his bank card out, because that was how I could get money, because the card has a PIN number, which is the secret code which you put into the machine at the bank to get money out. And Father hadn't written it down in a safe place, which is what you're meant to do, but he had told me, because he said I'd never forget it. And it was 3558. And I put the card into my pocket. Then I took Toby out of his cage and put him into the pocket of one of my coats, because the cage was very heavy to carry all the way to London. And then I went out of the kitchen door into the garden. I went out through the garden gate, and I made sure there wasn't anyone watching. And then I started walking towards the school, because that was a direction I knew. And when I got to school, I could ask Siobhan where the train station was. Normally, I would have got more and more frightened if I was walking to school, because I had never done it before. But I was frightened in two different ways. And one way was being frightened of being far away from a place I was used to, and the other was being frightened of being near where Father lived, and they were in inverse proportion to one another, so that the total fear remained a constant as I got further away from home and further away from Father. Like this. Fear, total, is almost equal to fear new place times fear near Father is almost equal to constant. It takes 19 minutes for the bus to get to school from our house, but it took me 47 minutes to walk the same distance, so I was very tired when I got there, and I hoped that I could stay at school for a little while and have some biscuits and some orange juice before I went to the train station. But I couldn't, because when I got to the school, I saw that Father's van was parked outside in the car park. And I knew it was his van because it said Ed Boone, Heating, Maintenance and Boiler Repair on the side with a crossed spanners sign. And when I saw the van, I was sick again. But I knew I was going to be sick this time, so I didn't sick all over myself, and I was just sick onto the wall and the pavement, and there wasn't very much sick because I hadn't eaten much. And when I'd been sick, I wanted to curl up on the ground and do groaning. But I knew that if I curled up on the ground and did groaning, then Father would come out of the school and he'd see me and he'd catch me and take me home. So I took lots of deep breaths, like Siobhan says I have to do if someone hits me at school, and I counted 50 breaths and I concentrated very hard on the numbers and I did their cubes as I said them, and that made the hurt less painful. And then I cleaned the sick away from my mouth and I made a decision that I would have to find out how to get to the train station, and I would do this by asking someone. And it would be a lady, because when they talk to us about stranger danger at school, they say that if a man comes up to you and talks to you and you feel frightened, you should call out and find a lady to run to, because ladies are safer. So I got out my Swiss Army knife, and I flicked out the saw blade, and I held it tightly in the pocket that Toby wasn't in, so that I could stab someone if they grabbed hold of me. And then I saw a lady on the other side of the street with a baby in a pushchair and a little boy with a toy elephant, so I decided to ask her. And this time I looked left and right and left again so that I wouldn't be run over by a car, and I crossed the road. And I said to the lady, "Where can I buy a map?" And she said, "Pardon?" And I said, "Where can I buy a map?" And I could feel the hand that was holding the knife shaking, even though I wasn't shaking it. And she said, "Patrick, put that down, it's dirty. A map of where?" And I said, "A map of here." And she said, "I don't know." And then she said, "Where do you want to get to?" And I said, "I'm going to the train station." And she laughed and she said, "You don't need a map to get to the train station." And I said, "I do, because I don't know where the train station is." And she said, "You can see it from here." And I said, "No, I can't. And also, I need to know where there is a cash machine." And she pointed and said, "There, that building, says Signal Point on the top. There's a British Rail sign on the other end. The station's at the bottom of that. Patrick, if I've told you once, I've told you 1,000 times, don't pick things off the pavement and stick them in your mouth." And I looked, and I could see a building with writing at the top, but it was a long way away, so it was hard to read. And I said, "Do you mean that stripy building with the horizontal windows?" And she said, "That's the one." And I said, "How do I get to that building?" And she said, "Gordon Bennett." And then she said, "Follow that bus." And she pointed to a bus that was going past. So I started to run. But buses go really fast, and I had to make sure that Toby didn't fall out of my pocket. But I managed to keep running after the bus for a long way, and I crossed 6 side roads before it turned down another street and I couldn't see it anymore. And then I stopped running, because I was breathing really hard and my legs hurt. And I was in a street with lots of shops, and I remember being in this street when I went shopping with Mother. And there were lots of people in the street doing their shopping, but I didn't want them to touch me, so I walked at the edge of the road. And I didn't like all the people being near me, and all the noise, because it was too much information in my head, and it made it hard to think, like they were shouting in my head. So I put my hands over my ears, and I groaned very quietly. And then I noticed that I could still see the railway sign that the lady had pointed at, so I kept on walking towards it. And then I couldn't see the railway sign anymore, and I had forgotten to remember where it was, and this was frightening, because I was lost, and because I don't forget things. And normally I'd make a map in my head, and I'd follow the map, and I'd be a little cross on the map that showed where I was, but there was too much interference in my head, and this had made me confused. So I stood under the green and white canvas roof outside a greengrocer's shop where there were carrots and onions and parsnips and broccoli in boxes that had a plastic furry green carpet in them, and I made a plan. I knew that the train station was somewhere near. And if something is nearby, you can find it by moving in a spiral, walking clockwise and taking every right turn until you come back to a road you've already walked on, then taking the next left, then taking every right, and so on. And that was how I found the train station. And I concentrated really hard on following the rules and making a map of the centre of the town in my head as I walked. And that way, it was easier to ignore all the people and all the noise around me. And then I went into the train station. Chapter 181. I see everything. That's why I don't like new places. If I'm in a place I know, like home or school or the bus or the shop or the street, I've seen almost everything in it beforehand, and all I have to do is look at the things that have changed or moved. For example, one week the Shakespeare's Globe poster had fallen down in the classroom at school, and you could tell because it had been put back slightly to the right, and there were three little circles of blue tack stain on the wall down the left-hand side of the poster. And the next day someone had graffitied Crow Aptok to lamppost 437 in our street, which is the one outside number 35. But most people are lazy. They never look at everything. They do what is called glancing, which is the same word for bumping off something and carrying on in almost the same direction. For example, when a snooker ball glances off another snooker ball. And the information in their head is really simple. For example, if they're in the countryside, it might be 1. I'm standing in a field that is full of grass. 2. There are some cows in the fields. 3. It's sunny with a few clouds. 4. There are some flowers in the grass. 5. There's a village in the distance. 6. There's a fence at the edge of the field and it has a gate in. And then they'd stop noticing anything, because they'd be thinking something else, like, oh, it's very beautiful here, or I'm worried that I might have left the gas cooker on, or I wonder if Julie has given birth yet. This is really true, because I asked Siobhan what people thought about when they looked at things, and that's what she said. But if I'm standing in a field in the countryside, I notice everything. For example, I remember standing in a field on Thursday, 15th June 1994, because Father and Mother and I were driving to Dover to get a ferry to France, and we did what Father called taking the scenic route, which means going by little roads and stopping for lunch in a pub garden. And I had to stop to go for a wee, and I went into a field with cows in, and after I'd had a wee, I stopped and looked at the field, and I noticed these things. 1. There are 19 cows in the field, 15 of which are black and white, and 4 of which are brown and white. 2. There's a village in the distance, which has 31 visible houses and a church with a square tower and not a spire. 3. There are ridges in the field, which means that in medieval times it was what's called a ridge and furrow field, and people who lived in the village would have a ridge each to do farming on. 4. There's an old plastic bag from Asda in the hedge, and a squashed Coca-Cola can with a snail on, and a long piece of orange string. 5. The northeast corner of the field is highest, and the southwest corner is lowest. I had a compass because we were going on holiday and I wanted to know where Swindon was when we got in France. And the field is folded downwards slightly along the line between these two corners, so that the northwest and southeast corners are slightly lower than they would be if the field was a flat inclined plane. 6. I can see 3 different types of grass and 2 colours of flowers in the grass. 7. The cows are mostly facing uphill. And there were 31 more things in this list of things I noticed, but Siobhan said I didn't need to write them all down. And it means that it's very tiring if I'm in a new place, because I see all these things. And if someone asked me afterwards what the cows looked like, I could ask which one, and I could do a drawing of them at home and say that a particular cow had particular patterns on it. And I realised that I told a lie in chapter 13 because I said I cannot tell jokes. Because I do know three jokes that I can tell and I understand, and one of them's about a cow. And Siobhan said I didn't have to go back and change what I wrote in chapter 13 because it doesn't matter, because it's not a lie, just a clarification. And this is the joke.